Well, hey, everybody, this is Dave. I hope you guys are doing great. Remember to, if you can, hang around for some additional discussion at the end of our last seminar today at the top of the hour so that we can extend and have just a discussion. For right now, so far, for the first three seminars, I'd like to hear from you, and just in one sentence, what's the most important thing you've taken away in any of these first three or all of these first three seminars?
Oh, this is Carol. Just too many to name.
I'm sorry, say it again, Carol, I didn't quite hear you.
Yeah, there's too many different things to name. I think I'm having more fun with this fourth one, though. The Twitter pitch, the Pixar pitch, I really have fun with those.
Well, good. You know, I didn't, I put those in the outline, but didn't really cover them in our discussion, so I'm glad you found them beneficial. So thanks for that that feedback, Carol. That's great.
Hi, this is Debbie.
Yeah.
I think that what was interesting to me is the first, I think you said maybe 10 words or at most 10 or 12 words will determine if they're going to work with you. So I'm trying to work with that idea very succinctly to get them emotionally involved at the same time that I'm only using like 10 words. Because I think people go away after that.
Yeah, and to clarify, and that is from what we know in neuroscience, that we attend to and retain up to 10 words at a time. And after that, attention and retention begin to tail off. So what someone is going to take away is what is said clearly, briefly, succinctly, and simply in those 10 words, because we know from, for example, behavioral economics, there's a whole principle of cognitive ease. Whenever it's easy to understand, we don't have to put our energy into paying attention, trying to understand, trying to synthesize it. As speakers, as writers, as communicators, we keep the burden of clarity ourselves. And that's what's really important. Whenever we have a communication with anyone, from a client to a prospect, we want to keep the burden of clarity ourselves, because remember how if you've had the experience of listening to somebody and really trying to, you know, kind of working sort of hard at figuring out what they're saying and what the importance is to you, or in a presentation you're listening to someone and, you know, you realize you're already planning what you're going to have for dinner that night. They've lost you. So the burden of clarity needs to be with the speaker or the writer, and that's what we're talking about doing, so that we can convey something clearly, specifically, simply to someone else. And that's huge. Yeah, so thanks for that.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
Okay, Bill Gammon.
Oh, hey, how are you, Bill?
I'm good. The most important lesson from the first three lessons for me, in 10 words. The inspection and distillation of our opening in each instance.
Exactly. That makes sense, and that sounds exactly right. Because and think about your own experience about how that initial engagement is either engaging or not. And if it's not, you're off and running. If it is, you've begun a conversation. Everything that we do with a client, with a prospect, with anyone who purchases anything, it's a relationship. You began a relationship by entering that person's circle to resonate with their experience so that then you can go someplace new. So it's about the relationship. It's about the initial engagement. Then what we do uniquely in professional coaching, that is unique among all the professions, is we have a collaborative framework. Every other profession has a consultative framework. You go, you present some issues, and the consultant, the doc, the attorney, every other professional then is a problem solver, tells you what to do and consults with you. We, however, co-create a new story with the client as point of reference. And client also here will be the person who is interested in whatever you're offering. So I'm using that generally. So great point, Bill. Thanks very, very much. Anyone else? What about one thing that hasn't been addressed that you hoped would be, that you still have some hope, maybe, that we'll address in this last seminar, that you want to be sure that you walk away with, or that you're not quite clear about yet? Anyone?
I have a question. Here's Carol.
Okay.
Pardon me, my voice is giving out, so it's a little hard to talk. I'm part of a business networking group that uses referrals as a way to garner success for people. I've not been able to figure out what I can say to them to convey to somebody outside who I haven't met what I do. That's been a real trick for me.
Okay, so you're going to say something to them, and they're going to pass on that message to someone else in order to generate a referral.
Yes.
Is that correct? And your question is,
how can you
help them best do that?
Yes.
Okay. Here's my thought about that. Nobody is going to work as hard as you are in doing this work. I mean, look, you guys have spent 3 hours already trying to figure out 10 words. Nobody's going to work as hard as you guys are. Nobody's going to know the principles of clarity, brevity, simplicity about the 10 words that our brains will attend to and retain. So make it easy for your referral person. Think about how hard it was for you to get to those 10 words, for you to get to your hub statement, for example, the very specific, defined niche and the benefit that's unique to professional coaching. Those of you who are doing this for professional coaching, remember, if you've done that, that was way harder than you had imagined it would be, I'll bet. And it took more work and more refinement and some nudging and a little Dutch uncle, if any of you have been in my training. So nobody's going to do that work. Nobody's going to be able to do it as well as you. Nobody's going to be as motivated as you. So do it for the referral person. Put it, and remember, I hear your coughs, and I resonate with you, but I don't want to hear it. Do the work of the person and put it on the back of your card, or give them something to walk away with where they don't have to make it up and synthesize it on the run, as they are not going to be able to do the same job you do. Put it, make the back of your business card work for you. Make it easy so that they can give somebody your business card and it says it for them, because you know nobody is going to put it together as much, as well and with as much care as you have, so do it for them. What do you think?
Yep.
I think it's great. You know, I've said, I don't think it's fair to have them do my work for me.
I don't know about fair, because fair is not a criteria here. I don't think it works. You know, in adulthood, there's no such thing as fairness, because there's no ultimate arbiter of fairness. And that's called adulthood, to use a scientific term. So it's not about fair. It's about what's going to work. And what's going to work is if you help them convey, think about the benefit that you bring them, any referral source, and be thinking about the referral sources, be thinking about the gatekeepers, the referral sources, and the benefit that you can bring them by the clarity and the simplicity. think about, this is a profession, but it's also a business. Do referral fees. Get referral fees. This is important. That's going to incentivize, too. But you're going to make it easy by helping them be more effective by giving them those 10 words, because they're never going to stumble on them with the same kind of care and work and resolve that you have.
Right, right.
Make sense? Raise other questions.
It does. No, it does. It makes sense. And I just appreciate your thoughts on it.
Absolutely. Well, let's move. Hold on to whatever you didn't ask or didn't talk about. We'll have some time at the end, and as I mentioned, we'll add on 10 or 15 minutes at the end just for discussion at the top of the hour. I want to move into our final topic and seminar, so I'm going to put us on lecture mode. So everybody get your coughs out of your system, and here we go in just a second. Okay, we're going to talk about neuromarketing, your professional services and products. So here's the quiz for the beginning of this seminar. The Wharton School of Business surveyed several thousand professionals to look at the major factor that determined whether someone engaged their professional services or declined their services. And they found out it was the same reason that they would decline, or the same reason, if it were positive, that they would engage the professional services. So which do you think was most important? Years of experience, reputation, amount of the fee, degrees and certifications, stating recommendations and fee clearly and confidently, or state of the economy? Now, we'll come back to that. I'll give you the answer. And I bet you know it. All right, here are four questions to consider. Do this immediately with a yes or no for each question. Jot down your immediate answer next to the question on your outline. Do you earn your living by offering others goods or services? Yes or no. Do you work for yourself or run your own operation, even if part-time? Does your work require elastic skills, the ability to do a variety of different functions throughout the day? And the final question, still a yes or no, do you work in education, training, human resources, or healthcare? If you answer yes to any one of these four questions, you are in sales and service. If you're a doctor, attorney, accountant, consultant, coach, or business professional, you're in sales and service. To deliver a fantastic experience to your prospects is the best sales strategy there is. So, neuromarketing simply is an integration of the biological and social sciences to understand unconscious choices and the underlying brain activity that determines consumer behavior, how we make our choices at a brain level, not all of which, most of which, are not conscious. When we engage potential prospects with a product or service in mind, we invite them to part with their resources, time, attention, effort, money. If they do, we will bring value, and they were going to benefit from the engagement. Teachers sell their students that the science lesson they're teaching is interesting and beneficial. In healthcare, the physical therapist helps someone recover from injury to handle resources, time, attention, effort, because patients can be healthier if they handle those resources wisely. To move people effectively and powerfully requires seeing them as a participant and a collaborator. That's exactly the framework we use. So, here's what happens when you don't do that. Here's what happens in a consultative framework. People consult a physician. Fewer than 50% who consult this expert and get a prescription, a recommendation specifically from this expert consultant, fewer than 50% actually fill it. Of those who do fill it, fewer than 50% take it as directed. So when someone's motivated by fear and pain, inconvenienced by time and travel, and have to pay to consult an expert, less than 25% actually follow that expert advice. It doesn't become their story. Even when they do it virtually, there's beginning evidence that it's the same kind of rate because it's a particular framework, a model. Almost 10,000 professionals around the world were surveyed to address this question. Nearly everyone, let me back up a minute because I want to engage you to write down a number. Think about this. Consider this question for yourself. Write down a specific number as soon as you hear my question. What percent of your real work involves convincing or persuading people to give up something they value for something you have? Something that you know will bring them great value. So, now let's get to the answer now that I've asked the question. Almost 10,000 professionals around the world were surveyed to answer this question. Almost everyone considered this aspect a crucial component of their success. Yet, while most people believe direct persuasion is crucial for professional success, the time allocated to engaging and directly persuading people was in the very low single digits. So what we find valuable and what we actually do may be significantly different. When we work for ourselves as entrepreneurs, we become salespeople as well. I'm not advocating that you think of it as sales or get salesy, and we'll return to that. What people do in sales is to move people. You can tell the ones who don't do this. Their kids are awfully skinny. The persuasion industry, now led by neuromarketing in very recent years, focuses on most everything we buy. What we purchase for emotional reasons and then justify by logic is shaped in ways so subtle that we probably fail to recognize the process. Here's an example of a failure in influence. A cigar manufacturer spent considerable money on an advertisement that depicted a beautiful, smiling woman handing out cigars to her husband and his friends. This was attractively done in an elegant English library setting and widely displayed. The result? A dramatic fall in cigar sales. Why? When men smoke cigars, they unconsciously feel dominant and important. By showing a woman encouraging a man to smoke and being subservient to her offering, the advertisement psychologically countered the male customer's intent. Now, the whole issue of white racial framing is an entirely different matter, so just focus on this study for right now. So here are some misconceptions about selling. For several years, my good buddy Art Wilson was the number one salesperson in IBM's group of over 10,000 healthcare sales professionals before he moved to a senior executive position there. He then took an early retirement to start his own hugely successful consulting company, working with the sales force of multinational corporations, and to co-found with me our What's Next Exec Retreats. You would never guess that he was in sales. He was a big, gentle, laid-back, lovable guy, somebody I kind of saw like me. In researching this material, I asked Art if there are common misconceptions about selling. He said, absolutely. Here are the two biggest ones, and I'm passing them on to you. One, selling is a natural gift. For more than 90% of people, including the most successful salesperson, this is simply not true. It's not a natural gift. Someone may do the right thing for the right reason, but it has to be combined with the right style and emotion. It's an art and a science. It's its own body of knowledge. And the second, the best salespeople have no call reluctance. The second biggest misconception. over 90% of the best salespeople regularly have call reluctance. They don't want to make cold calls. They don't want to initiate stuff. They'd rather go jogging. But they do it anyhow by getting into an optimum state of mind and sticking to their plan. Pick people you want to reach out to and do it. You don't have to be motivated, but you do have to have a plan and stick to it. And shrink the change, a designated number of contacts per day, per hour. From a number of conversations and interviews with outstanding sales professionals, these two questions form the heart of the sales exchange. One, if the person you are selling to agrees to buy, will his or her life improve? Two, when your interaction is over, will the world be a better place than when you began? If your answer to either of these questions is not yes, you need to recalibrate. It's been said that marketers most often make these mistakes: assuming people are rational, assuming people are eager for change, and assuming that once somebody knows things the way you know them, they're going to choose what you choose or what you offer. Here's the principle. It's what you think you already know that will most prevent you from learning. Now, let's look at the 1%, and as it applies to our discussion. Professor Harold Koh teaches law and emphasizes that in an attempt to understand the law, or in understanding just about anything, the key, he says, is to focus on the 1%, to not get lost in the details, but to think about the essence of what's really important, the 1% that gives life to the other 99%. Understanding that 1%, and especially being able to explain it to others, is the hallmark of a strong position. The 1% is the essence of simplicity and clarity. Whether you're selling a product or a service or trying to convince anyone of anything, what's the 1%? When you can answer that question and convey it to others, you and they are likely to be moved. Einstein logged in on this. He said, "If you can't state your position simply, you don't understand it well enough." And probably the best known currently alive marketer, Seth Godin, doubled down Einstein and said, "If you can't state your position in 8 words or less, you don't have a position." So the purpose of a 1%, or think of the purpose of a pitch or a communication, is not necessarily to move someone to adopt your idea. The purpose is to offer something so compelling that it begins a conversation. In other words, it initiates a relationship. That's the essence of your hub statement. You're not going to have somebody say, "Oh, yeah, you know, give me the platinum plan." You're going to have somebody, ideally, that will say, "Oh, tell me more." You're beginning a conversation. You're beginning a relationship. The purpose is to offer something so compelling that it begins a relationship. The measure of success after your statement is when this person says, "What? Tell me a little bit more about that." The other person begins then being a participant and can eventually arrive at an outcome that you jointly create. So the value proposition, there are basically three types of value proposition. And this is to consider to articulate your 1%. So consider these common types of value proposition. I'm just going to, as I mentioned, just touch on them because there's more detail in your outline. The one-word pitch. What's the one characteristic you most want associated with your name, your business, or your brand? A one-word equity. When anyone thinks of you, they associate that word. When anyone says that word, they think of you. Now, I amount for me recently, it was to make up a word, neuromentor. I wanted something that would really capture what I wanted to do in a peak performance training and institute. And it amalgamated psychology, neuroscience, and mentor coaching. And I liked it so much, I trademarked it and initiated the first of a new series of offerings. Now, other examples, each to date, a little more famous than NeuroMentor. What technology company do you think of when you hear the word search? What credit card company comes to mind when you hear the word priceless? Obviously, Google and MasterCard. In his 2012 re-election campaign, President Obama built his entire strategy around one word, forward. And here's the question pitch. And you can see this coming, I'll bet. In 1980, Reagan was running for president in a grim economy. He asked a simple question. Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? The question was designed to make people come up with their own reasons for agreeing or not. When people come up with their own answers for agreeing or believing something, they're going to endorse that belief more strongly and become more likely to act on it because it's their story, which is why when the physician gives a prescription, less than 1 in 4 do not consider it their story, don't even think about complying with it. Or the Twitter pitch, brief, simple, specific, a micro message of 140 or fewer characters. So the mark of an effective tweet like that of an effective pitch is that it engages recipients and encourages them to take the conversation further. Further may be responding, sharing a tweet, clicking a link, or signing on for a seminar. What tweets do you think have the highest rating? Readers assign the highest rating to tweets that ask questions of followers. This confirms the power of questions to engage and to persuade. It means it becomes a two-person process, not a one-person process of telling somebody something. So, listen to learn. Asking the right questions have way more power than giving people the right answers. Appreciative inquiry, something I think we don't quite explore nearly enough in mentor coaching. Appreciative inquiry can get much better results than seeking out and solving problems. So, the preparation is twofold, your purpose and your plan. Your purpose, 3 questions. What do you want them to know? What do you want them to feel? And what do you want them to do? So, your plan then, before you connect with a prospect, write down 4 things that will guide you. What should we talk about that would be the highest value objective of a client for this interaction? What are a couple of good questions to ask? If this call or discussion or email is successful, what's the next best action for that person and for me to take? And then maybe if we have time, what are some additional things to discuss? And for most people, the opposite of talking isn't listening, it's waiting. When other people speak, we usually divide our attention between what they're saying now and what we're going to say next. You know I'm right. Think about your last conversation with your partner. The result is a mediocre halfway position on both. Some professionals don't even bother to wait. A typical study found that physicians interrupt the majority of patients in the first 18 seconds that they began to speak during an appointment. And this often prevents the patients from describing what actually brought them to the office in the first place. Here's an example of thinking differently. Suppose you're raising money for a charity and ask someone to contribute $200. She says, well, I'm sorry, I can't give $200. Consider that an offer. Perhaps she can donate a smaller amount. Or she might say, no, I can't do that right now. Consider that an offer as well. Focus on the right now and ask when might be a better time. Or even consider the entire sentence as an offer, perhaps to contribute to your charity in some other way, such as being a volunteer. This way to hear responses as offers which can come in all shapes and sizes, is to reframe the way you listen to then change the way you respond. When both parties view an encounter as an opportunity to learn, the desire to sell or to win fades into the background. It's a mindset of collaboration and engagement. When we move from selling to serving, we engage the recipient as a collaborator and become empathically attuned to their needs and to our effectiveness in addressing those and benefiting that person. This is a non-salesy selling, the ability to influence, persuade, and engage behavior that will benefit that person and craft a link between what you can provide and what they may benefit from. We elicit from people what their specific goals are and frame what we can do to help them achieve those goals. So sales mastery then has three phases, if we think about it, three developmental phases: engage, enroll, and create conviction. Each component is based on knowing who your client is, the specific person you're about to engage in conversation. So I'm just going to hit some highlights here and let you look at the outline in more detail. But to engage is to connect and create interest. One way to think about this is an important aspect of your story is your hero. Who's the hero of your story? Heroes come in all varieties: the teller, the listener, the customer, the product, the location, the tribe. The hero needs to fit the goal. The hero is the character in the story who gives the audience a point of view. All the passion in the world won't do any good unless you have some place to place it. That's where the hero comes in. For example, the hero serves as guide and surrogate, the character that the reader or listener identifies with. If the audience experiences the story through the hero, and the story leads the hero to embrace a call to action, your audience will automatically hear your call to action as well. Remember, what stories do is activate various parts of the brain. The hero enables your audience to feel the change your story promises. In every story, there is an element that can make the difference. That's the hero, the character, the product, the brand that the reader or viewer identifies with. Focus on the experience you deliver. Remember, it's not about you and credentials and years of experience and all the, it's about the client, the person. Remember how book one, our first seminar, I should say, included how business and marketing stories like novels and film have three parts: the challenge, the struggle, the resolution. The hero faces the challenge, fights through the struggle to the resolution. And the hero may sometimes seem surprisingly hard to pinpoint, but unless you do, you don't have a story. When people, another example here, when people donate to a charitable cause, it's not to save the lives of tens of thousands of children. That's too abstract. That's like to sit down to write a book. I guarantee you're going to fail because nobody's going to sit down and write a book. You may sit down and write a page or 250 words. The hero faces the challenge and fights the struggle to the resolution. And when people donate to a charitable cause, they can be the hero. For example, donation increases when moving from the abstract to the specific. A famine in Ethiopia was significantly enhanced by 25% when they substituted a picture of Roika, a 7-year-old who faces a threat of severe hunger and even starvation. There was a threat of something, there was a picture of something specifically to respond to, not an abstraction. How do you make your prospect the hero for your professional engagement? We simply ask, what do you want to achieve? Where would you ideally like to be in 6 months? What constitutes an amazing achievement for you? Then you collaboratively have decided what to do next and how to get there. You need to know the single most important thing you could offer them. Remember, it's not about you, it's about them. To find that single most important thing, there are some keys to preparation. Know their challenges and need. Know your own service or your own product, the advantages and disadvantages. Engage a conversation to co-create a process to get to that answer. Again, clear, brief, and specific. And ultimately, you and the prospect arrive at the same place at the same time. So, to engage a prospect, whether it's service or product, connection and rapport are the foundation of all persuasion. Prospects will choose you because they trust you, like you, and specifically because they have confidence in you. This confidence is the belief that you can help them get what they want or need. Importantly, they will choose you because they believe you have their best interest at heart. Now, the answer to the Wharton School of Business quiz, the single factor that most determined whether someone engaged or declined professional services, the clarity and confidence of stating the recommendation and fee. Confidence is a state of mind. A state of mind is instantly contagious, faster than the fastest virus. Caring people buy from caring people. They'll even help you close as long as you have their best interest at heart. People want to feel cared for. We all want to be appreciated. It's part of our job to do that with our clients. People love people who change their state of mind. That's why entertainers are paid so much more than educators, pro athletes more than service people. We want to be around people who change our state for the better. And remember the law of reciprocation. Whatever you put out, it will come back manyfold, positive or negative. So there, just briefly, are three psychological tactics for earning instant credibility. One may be to argue against your own product or service. It's not for everybody. If it's not for the client, say it up front. Then whatever else you say is going to be more likely listened to. When you make a claim, provide proof to back it up. And there are different kinds of proof if no scientific studies exist. Statistics, personal stories, testimonials, research, professional or media-given accolades. That's why people ask for testimonials for books or for websites. The second aspect is to enroll. To enroll the client, discover their needs and challenges. The best way to do that is to ask, what specifically is your biggest challenge? And the real issues that we can help them solve are what we're listening for. Highlight the problems. Resonate with the pain, because this may be what the client wants to minimize or even deny. So this is, you listen for their needs, their wants, their challenges, and specifically remember how focus changes state of mind. What would be the best benefit to you of doing this? When the client comes up with the response, when your question prompts someone to imagine, it becomes real for them. If you told them instead of asked them, it wouldn't work. They wouldn't believe. Remember, facts and information are outside in, the outer circle of the brain, not the decision-making area. So, to engage, ask questions. Look at a focus together and co-create a possibility of moving into that together, collaboratively. Here's an exercise I'd suggest you consider. Each night, for 7 nights, come up with 3 ideas about how you can get potential prospects to feel like they already own your product or service before they even buy it. Think of creative and unique ways to do that consistently. or depending on your biorhythms, first thing in the morning. Now, after a week, you'll have 21 things. A bunch of them are going to seem goofy, but you only need one or two to change your business. Here's an example. A realtor whose clients like a particular house they viewed but haven't decided. So what he does is orchestrate an entire meal catered to the family in the home they're considering. They have a fabulous meal, see the fresh flowers he's brought in. They can picture themselves in that home, and they don't even have to because they're there now. That house and that experience became their story. His close rate, 80%. Most realtors are in the low single digits. Model success. Find successful people and see what they do. They most likely will make the experience real and use all five senses. Another example. If someone's eating food, this is a state changer, and the state links to the immediate anchor. That's why so much business is done at lunches and dinners. The realtor changed the states of mind of the purchaser and linked pleasure and family togetherness in that house. He created a vivid Rorschach for the family to project their hopes and their excitement. Whatever's happening around someone when they have a strong feeling, it will be linked, anchored. Now, it may not be logical. Is there any relationship between dog chow and a bell? Well, if they're coupled, Pavlov showed us that a dog thought so. Pavlov's dog linked the bell with food and salivated, then only the bell was enough to cue the anticipation. Here's another example. Put people in an environment that creates the state you want to link to your product. An example is, to me, the brilliant series of Super Bowl Budweiser commercials of the dog and the Clydesdale who are buddies. They induce a sack, and watch that again and again. They induce a state of mind of connection and bonding and the release of oxytocin in the brain. Here's the best signal of a successful oxytocin release. Aww. The message goes right to your hippocampus to connect that experience with Budweiser. Another example, the new car smell that puts you in a state to buy a new car. BMW even makes their brochures with a new car smell. Trust me, I know this. The total sensory and emotional experience with the salesperson, that's you, matters. Get creative, brainstorm. There's always a way to make it real and effective. Ask questions. Create an experience. Point, tell, and show. You want a blank that will blank? Is that correct? You want an investment that will bring you security and income? Is that correct? Ask a question that will put people's mind back on the challenge. Focus on the experience they're buying. Show to emphasize if all this came true. If you had a seminar for your people, what would be the most important thing they get out of it? If you have three results, what would those be? Plan that from the beginning. And if you don't get those, what would it cost you? Ask questions. Don't tell them. Ask how much more effectiveness or success would you have if you did this. Here's an example from one of my training program offerings. If your organization had an internal mentoring program, how would your people benefit, especially if the mentors were trained in the mind and brain sciences of change, including conversational, social, and emotional intelligence? Don't tell them, get them to tell you. Here's another exercise, since you asked for what do I do the next night. Write five questions to make it feel to the client that he or she already owns your product or service. An example is the real estate agent showing a house. The agent doesn't ask you what you think about the living room, but instead ask, where would you put your entertainment center? So they're picturing the ownership, and they've just placed their entertainment center in a house they don't own. The agent wants to have the prospect experience it as if they've already bought it. And the third aspect, compel, create conviction. Remember, people don't buy facts or features. They buy benefits for themselves. selling is the transfer of emotion. For someone to buy, they must feel certain they're going to get what they want. And what better way could we help them or ensure that to ask them specifically what they'd like to get out of each session or a coaching engagement? People will commit to what they help create. So conviction starts with you first, then your client. But they have to buy or attend an event for their reasons, not yours. The number one way, give them the experience and conviction that they'll get what they want out of your product or service. The number two way, match to their number one value. For example, if it's freedom, show them how this is going to enhance their freedom. Find the dominant emotion for buying, even though the prospect will want to believe it's for logical reason. Every decision is made on an emotional basis. Then logic, intellect, reason is attached to make it make sense. Copywriters tell us there are five great motivators for marketing. Fear. Car and life insurance people use this. Exclusivity. To be special or chosen. When narcissism goes shopping, a sense of specialness appeals, even creates a special bond, an exclusive offer, a private invitation. Greed. Now, although this has a negative connotation, the true meaning of greed is a rapacious desire for more, to succeed massively, which is why all of you are on the other end of this call right now, I would bet. Guilt. Nonprofits sometimes use this. And need for approval. Product advertisement for cars, watches, luxury products. So, the task of sales involves the science of neuromarketing. The questions you ask people determine what they focus on. This is really important to remember. At any time, we can only focus on a very small band of data, what's available to us. Our focus is kind of like a camera. You can only point it at a particular area and focus on that, and that leaves out everything else. Our brains, like that camera, is that we see what we focus on. So do only one feature at a time, not the whole load. And remember, our imagination is roughly 10 times more powerful than our will. So get people to envision. Now, to review from our second seminar, fear is the number one reason that stops action. So learn how to use imagination. Guide visualization to make it real for people, to paint it vividly. Ask questions. When you ask a question, it changes what somebody focuses on because it aligns the energy field of the brain. It's very much like an infant or a toddler who's so upset, can't be consoled, and for that infant, suddenly you rattle the car keys and boom, their state instantly changes because they focus on that. That's what questions do. People are well into the third paragraph of what they're passionately saying, and you interrupt and ask a question, and boom, they're focused on the question. That's why I ask with every mentor coaching client, would you give me permission to interrupt at some point if I feel that it would be helpful for us to look at something at that instant? And I give them permission to interrupt me. So emphasize choosing a short pain. Experience the discomfort and use the energy to move ahead, because denying the pain delays progress. Make it real and assume the sale. When people don't buy, it's because they've linked buying with more pain than not buying. When people do buy, they link buying with more pleasure than not buying. And remember this principle. People buy for emotional reasons and justify with logic in that order. We decide in the midbrain first, then boot it up to the frontal cortex. So here's one other thing I want to cover before a summary, just briefly, to convert objections into commitments. If someone has an objection, rather than counter it or ignore it or try to circumvent it, find out exactly what it is. An objection can equate with getting more information. The best salespeople average 5 objections before a conversion. And be sure that an objection is not the projective voice of the seller, that it's not something you're imagining and projecting. So consider an objection as a question in disguise, because an objection provides an opportunity to hear the primary concern. It can crystallize it so that you can then address it and reframe it. Understand the person's benefit and fear. And thirdly, listen to the real question. Objections can be signposts, your resources, and a mistake would be to fight the objection. The key to influence is to align with the person, to get inside the circle with them. In spite of the fear, will the benefit be greater in doing it? If the answer is yes, in their gut, they're going to proceed. The best way to respond to an objection is to take each objection and interpret it as a question. Rather than a reason for not buying, hear it as a request for more information. For example, I can't afford it. Reframed is, please show me how I can afford it so it's worth it. I have to talk it over with someone else. Reframed, please give me enough reason so I can go ahead and buy it without having to check and get someone else's opinion. So welcome an objection because it's information, and frame it as a stepping stone to success. Treat an objection as powerful, as important. Perhaps even compliment the objection if it's a good question, because it allows both of you to think about it and consider it. So here's a summary of some considerations to convert objections into commitments. Don't engage the objection by countering it, because focus directs attention. You don't want to focus on something negative. Hear them out. Feed it back as a question, because it puts the objection back to the questioner to then examine together and explain. Often when someone tries to explain an objection, they'll withdraw it. Get more information. What's the real objection? Align with the prospect to collaborate. In a collaboration, you're on the same side. Both of you are in the circle. If you fight an objection, it will limit you. Instead of countering the question or the objective, align with it. Get inside the circle. I appreciate or respect how you feel about that. Or, it is an expensive investment. Turn the objection into a question. Reframe it. Questions are the genesis of focus. You can't answer an objection, but you can answer a question. Seems like the real question is, can you get enough value to justify buying? Or it sounds like a concern is, how can you get benefits now? So focus on the benefit rather than the concern. For example, if there's an issue with expense, reframe it. Brag about it. Do it up front. Emphasize that it's an investment with exponential returns, but you have to believe that too. Focus on the benefit rather than the concern. Assume the sale as part of that. The best persuaders assume the sale. Congratulate them on a wise decision. Don't thank them for the sale. The congratulations focuses on a wise decision. So finally now, the psychology of closing. This is the point that both salesperson and the prospect may hate the most. Do the close as quickly and painlessly as possible. For a sample session, it's making a recommendation of your professional services. Now, here's an example of a close that's quick and painless. A man had a painful tooth that he knew needed to be extracted. He called his dentist, whose patient he'd been for a long time. The two knew each other really well. He asked the dentist how much he would charge him to extract a tooth and how long it would take. The dentist said, I'll charge you $185 and it'll only take a minute. The man responded, only a minute? That's a lot of money for just a minute. The dentist said, well, if time is an issue, I can take as long as you want. Have your closings planned in advance, word for word, your recommendation. but sound natural and spontaneous, like you're talking, not reading a script. Engage a positive, enthusiastic mindset. Clarify the client's requirements. Help them understand what you're offering. Facilitate collaboration. Focus on the benefit. And do all this in a clear, brief, simple way in 2 to 3 sentences. So, some closing strategies. Never tell a prospect that they're wrong. People against their will are of the same opinion still. Go with the objection, highlight it as a valid concern, and then engage the message. Get third-party proof. Somebody who's had a similar objection saying how it worked and how they're glad they did it. Don't knock the competition. Sell the value and the benefits of your service or your product. Don't engage in personal issues with the client. Don't assume authority you don't have. You have to be able to keep the promises that you give or that you infer. And avoid negative expectations, such as deciding the person's not going to buy. That's your issue. So remember, in summary, the hero is the person, place, product, or brand that enables someone to feel the change your story promises. How can you make your client the hero of his or her own story, not your story? So make it easy and create a future. Create a relationship that lasts through the years. The most important part of the engagement is to give, in my view, more than's expected to generate an ongoing relationship. And you may want to prevent buyer's remorse, future pacing. Future pace each time someone purchases. Have buyers imagine themselves in the future, ways they're going to use the product or service in the future. A year from now, what will you be doing with this training that will make you glad you've done it? Give them a reason to buy, theirs, not yours, emotional and logical. People will put off buying if they can, so build units of conviction. Make it fun. Laugh. Change states. If you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. Have I quoted my favorite grandmother enough by now? So, in summary, strategies of successful top sellers, marketers, affect your own emotional state. There's a reason this is first. Reset after the last experience. A number one quality. Prepare yourself physically and emotional. Get in state. Remember, people buy states, and the best thing you can do is to be confident. Qualify prospects. Manage their state. Give them a reason to justify buying, to satisfy a need. Imagine inventing a device that can record memories, dreams, ideas, and transmit them to your brain. This device, this game-changing technology, is called storytelling. And that's what we've been talking about in terms of developing the whole mind and brain sciences applied to marketing to your success, is to develop your story the very best way possible and to convey it in meaningful ways. We're in discussion mode now, so I'm interested in thoughts, questions, things that might be helpful to talk more about.
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I'm just wondering, could you clarify the exercise that we should do for 7 nights to make the client feel like they've already purchased the product? We're just thinking up scenarios or we're asking questions?
Imagine the client has the product or the service. Come up with 3 ideas about how you can get them to feel like they already own your product or service before they buy it. Think of creative and unique ways to do that. and put those three ideas down each night. Now, as I said, a bunch of them are going to seem goofy, especially the next morning, but you only need one or two that can really change the course of things. In other words, this is an exercise to get into their experience, to imagine them owning your product or your service or the engagement with you and experiencing from that perspective. You're going to be more informed once you've done this and once you've thought about how to convey this to them. And something over time is going to click, but this process is useful in and of itself. If you come up with, if 0 out of 21 work, you've engaged in a very necessary process, but I'll bet 1 or 2 is going to be helpful. Does that make more sense?
It does. Thank you.
Okay, yes. And someone else spoke at the same time. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, David, it's Eric.
Yeah, hey, go ahead.
Long time no speak. You know what's amazing? This is really a comment. You know what I find amazing about all this is really the simplicity of it all. Everybody tells stories. Everybody reacts to certain psychological, I don't know what the word I'm looking for is, but psychological reactions. If you really give this thought, it's really very simple to put all this into place, which is very encouraging.
That's been the case for some time, and I think you summarized it. Only by really understanding the complexity of something can we see its true simplicity. And the simplicity for me is to get to the elegance and the simplicity of what's happening at a mind and a brain level, because you can't get any simpler than that. And then how can we use that to inform what we do before we attach all this complexity and meaning and all that, but to really look at the essence. So, yes. Thanks, Eric.
Dave, Bill Gammon.
I'm sorry, this is who?
Bill Gammon.
Yeah, hey, Bill, go ahead.
On your website, you have the first two summaries put up, but the third one is missing. Will it be up by tomorrow with this one probably, or was there some problem
now,
with it?
Just a second. At the CTA website for these presentations?
If that's where it is, if it's the CTA website.
Right.
There's only two of them up, not the third one.
I'll check on that, because the third from last time should be up, and this should be up sometime tomorrow.
And I find it helpful to go back and review those so that my note-taking can be more complete. And
yeah, good. Okay. I'll check.
The experience of hearing it again, you pick up on some things you missed the first time.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, thanks for highlighting that. I'll definitely check.
Thank you.
You bet. Well, what else would you like to talk about?
I have a question.
Yes,
hi, sorry, it's Debbie.
Debbie, okay, hey.
Do you get personal, say anything about your own life at all during a session? I've been asked many questions, and I try and divert it, you know, back to them. But is it helpful to tell a story or two?
Are you talking about mentor coaching clients now?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So you see how the framework is helpful, because that helps to understand the meaning and in a context. So you're talking about mentor coaching clients, and your question there is, do you ever, or what is the best way if you want to talk about personal stories?
The coaches, my own.
Okay. And what purpose would you have in mind for telling your own story?
Well, to drive a point home how something can work out, I had a client who once asked me to tell her my entire story, and I was very reluctant, and she said, I really want to, and I did, and then she signed up for 2 years. But I don't know, you know, she was what she was looking for, and someone else asked me something similar. So do you make it part of a story where it, when they ask a question, if you can bring it to a
succinct story that worked out for you?
Okay, first of all, what you did worked. So for the two-year engagement, that's a basic principle in mentor coaching for our clients. If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. So now there's a subtle variation here that I want to highlight, because the work with a client, this is to everybody. The work with a client needs to be about developing the client's story from the point of reference of the client. So whatever we do would be governed by the principle of what's going to help the client further his or her story. Now, a significant part of not hijacking the agenda is not having an attachment to the outcome. If you try to fix something, that's a pretty definite attachment to a specific outcome that you believe is the best. And a client's going to always be able to know or feel that. And if they're looking to do the work in an easier way, to say, well, I'll just do it like Debbie did it, that is a takeaway from them crafting their own version. But more important, it takes away the point of reference from them as the heart of their story. And I would have, in the back of my mind at least, wondering if that is a repetition of an attachment pattern to abandon one's own self and take a point of reference in someone else. So just to answer your question simply, is whatever, in my view, whatever helps the client get to the position of being massively successful in his or her life. Now, as you might guess, I value stories because stories are the way we make sense of things, the way we remember things. It engages both the left and the right brain. So often a story will bring together something in a more specific or a superordinate way or just a better way. So I collect stories, and I may have a brief story. I'll give you an example in just a second. May have a brief story so that the client can help. I can help the client better understand something. Now, if I have a story that is unique to a specific situation, I might use that story, but that I think I'd have to really think about, because what makes my story better than the host, than the tens of thousands of stories that I've become familiar with in the literature? So here's an example of that. Here's an example from a recent client. I was working with a financial professional who was about to have a meeting with a high net worth individual, and the result of that meeting was going to determine whether $35 billion was going to be invested with him. So he said, Dave, what would you do in this situation? Now, I have not been in that situation. You know, I've never gone over $34 million myself. No. The reason that I responded the way I did is I thought I had a better answer. So I helped him look at various things, and we had talked in a number of ways about optimum performance and peak performance and getting in state and doing that. And we kind of reviewed that, looked at that, and he knew from a number of things that we had talked about and that I sent him that, you know, he knew what to do, and he just wanted to review that. I said, a couple of quick things. How long are you going to be meeting with this client and the people this client was bringing? He said, well, you know, I have allotted 4 hours. And I said, from when to when? And he told me from when to when. I said, are you going to have lunch or serve a snack? He said, well, hadn't really thought about it. I said, here's something to think about. Let me tell you a story. This is a study of 8 Israeli judges that they were studied in terms of the time of day about their decision-making. Their usual rate of parole granting was 35%. Right after the morning snack, lunch, and the afternoon snack, their rate of parole granting was over 65%. They were in a much more benevolent mood. Now, right before the longest period of time when their blood glucose was lowest, right before noon, right before ending the day, their rate of granting paroles was almost 0%. So all the things we've talked about factor in exactly how you're going to frame your presentation, when you're going to make the pitch for the decision, and think about the timing of your snack or your lunch. So we looked at that and looked exactly at what it was going to be, not you know, big bolus glucose release, but the other thing I said, one other thing, where are you going to sit and where is the primary client, the decider, going to sit? He said, well, I haven't thought about it. I said, well, let's think about it. There are two there are two studies from Italy that have shown that when you offer information in someone's right ear, they are 75% more likely to agree with you than when you offer it in their left ear. He said, I know where I'm going to sit. I mean, who knew all this time I've been talking in my wife's left ear? So those are just some ideas of some stories that I might tell if it will benefit a situation and help someone come to a better decision to achieve or sustain peak performance or dealing with extreme success. That's something that I'm working on now because I think we're way underestimating how important that is in coaching. People who have massive success, extreme success, and have difficulty dealing with it. So you'll, you know, stay tuned for that. So does that answer your question?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that is what I meant, of course. Not to hijack it, but if it's a similar situation where it could prove the point of what they are asking.
Be careful that you're not subtly working in how you'd like them to do it and do it your way, or that there's not some narcissistic gratification that we might have in telling somebody a story in which we're the hero. Remember, the hero is our client, not us. So it's not about us, it's about them. And the principle here, whatever story you tell or don't tell, or whoever or whatever it's about, is it going to help the client take the next step or steps toward significant success?
Right.
So that's the organizing principle that I would have. So it's a great question, and I'm glad we had a chance to talk about that.
Perfect. Thank you.
Absolutely. We still have, you know, 2 or 3 minutes. What else, other things that might be helpful for us to talk about? Anything remaining or anything we didn't touch on that you're curious about that we could do just briefly? Well, it's totally been a privilege working with you. I've really enjoyed putting this together, and especially after hearing from you about what you'd like specifically to be sure that we cover, what you'd like to walk away with. That made a difference. It helped me organize some aspects of the discussion and some of my comments. I hope we've met together those objectives that you have and maybe even extended beyond where you had imagined. And this is often the case with a client, because a client can only envision from their own system. So often they're going to get beyond what they had ever imagined because we've helped that system transform into new ways of looking and doing and being. So I hope this has been transformative for you and maybe just a beginning to look at things in a different way. I'll be eager to hear responses or feedback from you. If I can help any of you in any way, I hope you'll let me know. It's been a privilege doing this with you. Thanks so much for your energy, for your input, and the collaboration together. I hope we're not done. And take good care of yourselves, especially during...
Thank you, David.
Absolutely.
Thank you, David.
See you guys.
Thank you, David.
Bye now. Thanks so much.
Mm-hmm.